Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Turn to Joshua 12. I am well aware of my reputation. Let me just say that right out front. Being aware of my own reputation, I want you to mark the date, because this is going to be a red letter night. I am aware that there are people who think that I can talk for an hour about any one verse in the Bible. And I can. I have this capability. There are people who, you know, get all excited if I make it to like three verses in one sermon. You know, woo, three verses. That's what they sound like. Woo, three verses. But tonight, we're going to start tonight in Joshua 12. And we will finish the night in Joshua 22.
Wow.
Uh-huh. I know. Took you back, didn't it? I know. Now, the reason we're going to be able to pull that off is because the big middle section of the book of Joshua is information. The first bit of information that makes up Joshua 12 is a list of all the kings that were defeated by Israel. And it is a long list of names and cities that is a record. And it has its purpose. It has its function. It is a record of all the kings and all the cities that Israel conquered. And I think that record serves two purposes. One, it tells future generations of Israel that all of this area does now belong to you because the kings of these areas were conquered. And it also serves as a record to anyone else in the area who might think that they want to rise up against Israel. Look at the list of kings and cities they've already conquered. It would be wise not to go against them. And so chapter 12, verse 1 starts, "These are the kings of the land whom the sons of Israel defeated, and whose land they possessed beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise, from the valley of Arnon as far as Mount Hermon, and all the Arabah in the east." And then he starts the list. Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon and ruled from Aor. And the whole rest of the chapter is that listing. But I want to point out, starting at verse 6, an important concept that we have to keep in mind in order to understand the lists and information that's coming up. Verse 6 says, "Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the sons of Israel had defeated them, and Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave that land to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh as a possession." This is the land that is east of the Jordan. Remember way back when we first talked about them arriving at the Jordan River after the 40 years of wandering. They entered into battle there and they defeated the local kings there. And then Moses was approached by a couple of the tribes, particularly the Reubenites and the Gadites. And then they were joined by the half-tribe of Manasseh, who said, "We've conquered this land. Let us stay in this land. Let us just have this land." But then a deal was struck with them that they would have to come with their brethren and fight to conquer the whole of the land that was promised to Israel nationally, and that once that land was secured, they could then go back east of Jordan and possess that land. So the 12 tribes of Israel actually overflow the immediate borders of Canaan right there and are not all west of the Jordan River. There are a couple of tribes east of the Jordan River, including the half-tribe of Manasseh. And you're going to see in a little while that some of the Manassites, half of the tribe of Manasseh, end up west of the River Jordan, while some of them end up on the east side of the River Jordan, because both Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph, became, exactly the way Jacob predicted, they became such numerous tribes, such large people groups, that eventually the northern kingdom, the northern 10 tribes, become known by the nickname Ephraim, and even as Mount Ephraim, because they are the dominant people group among the 10 northern nations. And half of the Manassites are on one side of the Jordan River, and half the Manassites are on the other side of the river, and that's going to be important by the time we get to later chapters. When we get into chapter 21, 22, there's going to be a struggle that arises about these people who are on the other side of the Jordan River. So you have to know who they are and why they're over there. Then the rest of the chapter is a list of kings, names that that you can read for yourself if you'd like, cities that you can read. We're just going to move forward. Chapter 13 then says, now Joshua was old and advanced in years when the Lord said to him, you're old and advanced in years. If I were Joshua at that moment, I'd be tempted to say, yeah. And very much of the land remains to be possessed. This is the land that remains, all the region of the Philistines and those of the Girgashites, from Shihor to the east of Egypt, and then there is a list from there to the south, says verse 4, and the land of the Gebelite. And verse 6 goes into all the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon. And then you get into apportion this land for an inheritance. So Joshua is told in verse 7, there's still land that has not been conquered, and you need to apportion that land in advance to the tribes, apparently to inspire the tribes to recognize that that is their land, so go get it. And there is going to be later a little bit of discussion, a little bit of reticence on the part of some of the tribes who are going to come to Joshua and say, we'd like this, but it's going to be tough to take. And he says, you're able, go do it. You know, God's on our side. Go take that land. It's going to be yours. Now, therefore, apportion this land for an inheritance to the nine tribes and to the half-tribe of Manasseh. With the other half-tribe, the Reubenites and the Gadites, they received their inheritance, which Moses gave them, beyond the Jordan to the east, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them, from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of Arnon, with the city that is in the middle of the valley and all the plains of Medeba, as far as Dibon. And then he continues listing cities, the kingdoms, the layout of that land, and saying what belongs to who. Verse 15 tells us, so Moses gave an inheritance to the tribes of the sons of Reuben according to their family. All the territory was from Aroer, and he describes all of that. Now, once we've got that, Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and all the land that's apportioned to them on the east side, we then get to chapter 14. Chapter 14 we read last week, that is the story of Caleb requesting from Joshua that he be given the land where the giants are and that he have the opportunity to take that land that he was promised to begin with. So we read all of that last week, and he attacked the Kenizzites in that area. Starting in chapter 15 then, we hear about the territory of Judah. The reason this is important is because you're going to see a particular layout for what comes to be known as the southern kingdom. And it's very specific. God puts Benjamin and God puts Judah to the south and the other tribes to the north. So right away, God sees them as two people groups. And what you've got to remember is that even when they were in the land of Egypt, God refers to them, Ephraim and Judah, the northern tribes and the southern tribe, he refers to Israel nationally in Egypt as two sisters. And he gives them the name, Aholah and Aholibah, and talks about how the one went whoring after her lovers, and then her sister saw it, and even for all that she saw her sister do, she didn't change her ways. So God even speaks to Hosea about national Israel in Egypt as being two, and then identifies the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom as those two sisters by name, Aholah and Aholibah. So the territory of Judah is then spelled out. And that is chapter 15. However, in the middle of chapter 15, starting at verse 13, we have a story about Caleb again. And since we took the time to understand the Caleb story, we have to understand the whole of what happened to him, because Joshua took the time in the midst of explaining what land Judah was going to get to say, starting in verse 13, now he gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, a portion among the sons of Judah, according to the command of the Lord to Joshua, namely Kiriath Arba, Arba being the father of Anak, and that is now known as Hebron. And Caleb drove out from there three sons of Anak, the Anakim, Sheshai, and Ahiman and Talmai, who were the children of Anak. And they went up from there against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "The one who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it, I will give him Aksha, my daughter, as a wife." And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brothers of Caleb, captured it, so he gave Aksha, his daughter, as a wife. And it came about that when she came to him, she persuaded him to ask her father for a field. So she alighted from the donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you want?" And she said, "Give me a blessing. Since you have given me the land of the Negev, give me also springs of water." So he gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. This is now the inheritance of the tribe of the sons of Judah according to their families. And the last of the families he mentions is Caleb, and mentions that Caleb's inheritance goes through his daughter, just so no one could argue about that. And then he goes into the inheritance of the sons of Judah, names them by name, and says what area they get, and that is the balance of chapter 15. If you want to see those names and see the names of those cities, unless I had an enormous map up here and could point to the various areas, just reading these words and reading these names isn't going to be any real benefit to anybody here outside of me demonstrating my ability to read archaic names and pretend I know how to pronounce them. So, chapter 16 then gets into the territory of Ephraim. And it says, "Then the lot for the sons of Ephraim," and it spells out the area that they were going to get. It went from Jordan to Jericho, to the waters of Jericho on the east of the wilderness, going up from Jericho through the hill country to Bethel. And it went from Bethel to Luz and continued to the border of the Arkites at Adaroth. And then he goes on to explain that the sons of Joseph, Manasseh, and Ephraim received their inheritance. And this is the territory of the sons of Ephraim according to their families. So there's a little breakdown of the families there. Chapter 17 then says, now this is the lot for the tribe of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph. Now remember, we've got Manassites over on the east of Jericho, and they got their land over there with the Gadites and the Reubenites. But now here are other Manassites looking for their particular land and property, since he was the firstborn to Joseph. To Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilead, was allotted Gilead and Bashan, because he was a man of war. So the lot was made for the rest of the sons of Manasseh, according to their families, for the sons of Abiezer, and the sons of Helek, and for the sons of Asriel, and for the sons of Shechem, and the sons of Hefer, and the sons of Shemidah. These were all male descendants of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, according to their families. However, Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, only daughters, and these are the names of his daughters, Mahlah, and Noah, and Haglah, and Milcah, and Tirzah. And they came near before Eleazar the priest, and before Joshua the son of Nun, and before the leaders, saying, "The Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among our brothers." Remember that? There was a discussion where these women went to Moses and said, "We're the only women. We don't have any brothers. Are we going to lose our inheritance?" And Moses said, "No, the inheritance then is going to go through these women." So, according to the command of the Lord, he gave them an inheritance among their father's brothers. Thus there fell 10 portions to Manasseh beside the land of Gilead and Bashan, which is beyond the Jordan. So now Joshua is laying it out plainly, what I had already said. Beyond the Jordan, on the east of Jordan, Gilead and Bashan was given to Manasseh. But because of these women and their families, there were 10 portions of land given besides that that were given to these women who are descendants of Manasseh. So there are Manassehites scattered around all over the place.
All right, now.
Yeah.
Did Manasseh get the birthright? Did he get the double portion of land?
To be honest with you, Gladys, there's some debate whether double portion means each tribe. Since Joseph was one of the sons, it would have been the tribe of Joseph. But then he got twice as much portion, one for each of his two sons. And so Joseph's portion became twice as much, so that there was some for Ephraim and some for Manasseh. That might be what the double portion is a direct reference to. So then he goes on to the border of Manasseh from Asher and the land of Tapua and what the south side is. The south side belonged to Ephraim and the north side to Manasseh. Then he talks about Issachar and Asher and Manasseh, and he's just laying out the land. He's just telling everybody exactly where the particular land falls. But in chapter 17, here in verse 12, we read, "But the sons of Manasseh could not take possession of these particular cities." Well, we should back up to see verse 11, what those cities are. "And in Issachar and in Asher, Manasseh and Beth-Shean, and its towns, and Ibleam and its towns, and the inhabitants of Dor and its towns, and the inhabitants of Endor and its towns, and the inhabitants of Tanakh and its towns, and the inhabitants of Megiddo and its towns. The third is Nepheth, but the sons of Manasseh could not take possession of these cities because the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. And it came about when the sons of Israel became strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely." That is why in future stories about Israel and their dealings with the Canaanites, there still are Canaanites in the land. If we get the impression that as Joshua and Israel swept through Canaan, they wiped out everybody, you would ask later, well, where do these Canaanites come from? If they had in fact wiped out all the sons of Anak, where does Goliath come from? And so there were just some people who remained there, who seem to have just kind of hunkered down and camped there. They were part of a movement called Occupy Canaan, and they wouldn't move on when they were supposed to. It was a tent sit. Never mind.
Megiddo, that's where the last battle happens.
Right. And hence the word Armageddon. Armageddon is a direct reference to Megiddo, the Megiddo Plain. So then the sons of Joseph, verse 14, said to Joshua, "Why have you given me only one lot and one portion for an inheritance, since I am a numerous people whom the Lord has thus far blessed?" And Joshua said to them, "If you're a numerous people, go up to the forest and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and of the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you." And the sons of Joseph said, "The hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who live in the valley land have chariots of iron, both those that are in Beth-Shean and its towns, and those that are in the valley of Jezreel." And Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, "You are a numerous people and a great power. You shall not have one lot only, but the hill country shall be yours. For though it is a forest, you shall clear it, and to its farthest borders it shall be yours. For you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron, and though they are strong." So there's the encouragement to go ahead and take the forest land and clear it and make it more land. So this was something that Joshua had to deal with, that the Ephraimites and the Manassites were just so many people that he had to continue to give them portions of land because the strip of land that was allotted to them initially was just not enough. Chapter 18 then gets into the rest of the land being divided and starts, "The whole congregation of the sons of Israel assembled themselves at Shiloh, and they set up the tent of meeting," which is the tabernacle in the wilderness, the place of meeting, the tent where the Ark of the Covenant was. "And the land was subdued before them. And there remained among the sons of Israel seven tribes who had not divided their inheritance." In other words, they knew what their inheritance was, but they had yet to go in and take the land, divide it up among their families. Because, again, I think we get the impression that this all happened in a weekend, and that Joshua and the Israelites came in like on a Thursday, and by Monday they owned everything. Remember earlier we saw that the first few battles over the first few cities was 5 years in the doing. What we're going to find out in a few minutes is that there's even been a change of priesthood because so much time has gone by, that Eleazar, the high priest, has died, and that one of his sons has now risen up, Phinehas has risen up in his stead, because so much time has gone by. People have lived and died and areas have been conquered. This didn't happen instantaneously. It was a continual series of battles and encroachments and moving out across the land. So Joshua said, verse 3, to the sons of Israel, how long will you put off entering to take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you? Provide for yourselves 3 men from each tribe, that I may send them, and that they may arise and walk through the land and write a description of it according to their inheritance, and then they shall return to me, and they shall divide it into 7 portions. Judah shall stay in its territory on the south, and the house of Joseph shall stay in their territory on the north. That's significant. Notice what he just did. He just said that Judah is the south and Joseph is the north. And it's significant, too, because those are the two, when you go back to the blessings that Jacob gave to his 12 sons, when he talked about what was going to befall them in the latter days, and he gave blessings, and not always good blessings, but he spoke over each of his 12 sons. And he divided the Abrahamic covenant, in particular, between Judah and the sons of Joseph. And the sons of Joseph got the physical attributes of the Abrahamic covenant, that inheritance portion. They got the birthright blessing. But Judah was the tribe through which Messiah was going to come, and the gathering of the people was going to be to him. And so the Abrahamic spiritual blessing that through his descendants all the nations of the earth were going to be blessed is flowing through Judah. But the birthright land inheritance is flowing through Ephraim, who just happened to be the largest tribe there at the time, because God is blessing the tribe that has the birthright blessing. And so even here, Joshua makes clear what the division is. Judah will stay in its territories on the south, and the house of Joseph will be in its territories on the north. So you've already got that northern kingdom, southern kingdom division set up, even though they are national Israel. And you shall describe the land in 7 divisions and bring the description here to me, and I will cast lots for you here before the Lord our God. For the Levites have no portion among you, because the priesthood of the Lord is their inheritance. Gad and Reuben and the half-tribe of Manasseh also have received their inheritance eastward beyond the Jordan, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them. And then the men arose and went, and Joshua commanded those who went to the land to describe the land, saying, go and walk through the land and describe it and return to me, and then I will cast lots for you before the Lord in Shiloh. So the men went and they passed through the land. They described it by cities in 7 divisions in a book, and they came to Joshua to the camp at Shiloh. And Joshua cast lots for them in Shiloh before the Lord, and there Joshua divided the land to the sons of Israel according to their divisions. So what's happening is the land that hadn't yet been conquered is divided up into 7 different divisions, and then the 7 tribes who still need land, basically he lays out, here's the 7 people, here's the 7 lands, God, which one do you want for which? And he casts lots to find out which is which. Pardon me?
Who got what?
But by the way, just notice the confidence Joshua had to have in an absolutely sovereign God to say, we're just going to cast lots for this. And however this falls is going to be the will of God. And that's the land you're going to go fight for and conquer. And he's going to fight for you and you're going to take that land. That's belief in an absolutely sovereign God. Because Joshua was a Calvinist. Okay, now, just let that go. Just move on past that and just keep going. Starting at verse 11, it says, now the lot of the tribe of the sons of Benjamin came up according to their families, and the territory of their lot lay between the sons of Judah and the sons of Joseph. So they're down there part of Judah. And their border on the north side was from the Jordan. Then the border went up on the side of Jericho to the north, and then went up to the hill country westward, and it ended at the wilderness of Beth Avon. Then he goes into each of the families and the borders. We don't need to go into all of that, but it's laying out the territory of Benjamin. Chapter 19 then starts, and the second lot fell to Simeon, to the tribe of the sons of Simeon according to their families, and their inheritance was in the midst of the inheritance of the sons of Judah. So they had an inheritance in Beersheba and Sheba and Molada, and then all the cities in the areas, Ramah of the Negev. That's the inheritance of the tribe of Simeon. Then the territory of Zebulun starts in verse 10. The third lot came up for the sons of Zebulun, according to their families. In verse 17, the fourth lot fell to Issachar, according to their families. Verse 24, now the fifth lot fell to the tribe of the sons of Asher, according to their families. Verse 32, the sixth lot fell to the sons of Naphtali, and to the sons of Naphtali according to their families. And then verse 40, you have the seventh lot fell to the tribe of Dan according to their families, and their territory of their inheritance was Zorah and Ashtuel, and on it goes from there. It describes the territory of Dan. Go to verse 49, and it says, when they finished apportioning the land for inheritance by its borders, the sons of Israel gave an inheritance in their midst to Joshua, the son of Nun. And in accordance with the command of the Lord, they gave him the city for which he asked, Timnath-Serah, in the hill country of Ephraim, and he built the city and he settled it. These are the inheritances which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the households of the tribes of the sons of Israel distributed by lot in Shiloh before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So they finished dividing the land. Chapter 20 is where we begin actually reading tonight. We are covering some ground. I'm telling you. Just a big overview there of what happened. And I tried to pull out the key moments. Then the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, designate the cities of refuge, of which I spoke to you through Moses, that the manslayer who kills any person unintentionally, without premeditation, may flee there, and they shall become your refuge from the avenger of blood. And we established when we read this before that the avenger of blood was usually a family member who would try to avenge the initial death. In reading a little bit about cities of refuge in the last couple of weeks preparing to get up to this point in Joshua, one commentator made an interesting point that I hadn't really thought about before, but there's a great wisdom in the cities of refuge beyond just protecting the innocent. It also stops the cycle of continual violence. Because all the way back to Genesis 4, when you have Cain slaying Abel, from that point you have vengeance on vengeance on vengeance. As people grew more sinful and more numerous, of course we read by the time of Noah that there was nothing but wickedness continually in their hearts. And that once you start the cycle, which is still very typical human behavior. Hatfields and McCoys. Boy, isn't that a perfect example of what we're describing. That once somebody kills somebody and then they go out for vengeance, then the ones who killed in the first place feel they have to avenge the one that was killed in response, and there's this continual cycle of revenge. And so the city of refuge also stops the cycle of revenge. And very clearly is a typification. When we looked at the cities of refuge before, they are very clearly a typification of what Christ did. There's a gospel being preached here in the symbols in the city of refuge. Here's what I mean. Verse 4, he, this person who killed unintentionally without premeditation, he didn't hate his brother in his heart, it just happened. He shall flee to one of the cities and shall stand at the entrance of the gate of the city and state his case in the hearing of the elders of the city. And they shall take him into the city to them and give him a place so that he may dwell among them. And if the avenger of blood pursues him, then they shall not deliver the manslayer into his hand, because he struck his neighbor without premeditation and did not hate him beforehand. And he shall dwell in that city until he stands before the congregation for judgment, until the death of the one who is the high priest in those days. Then the manslayer shall return to his own city and to his own house, to the city from which he fled. In other words, he's a free man, which is just a beautiful, beautiful typification very early on, way back here in the law, that God would make this rule that there would be cities of refuge where men could flee who had committed a crime, who had killed somebody without hatred, without premeditation, And in order to protect them from the one who wants to kill and destroy them, they could go to the city of refuge and stay there until the death of the high priest. And then they were free men again. And of course, the book of Hebrews identifies Jesus as our high priest. And it was the death of our high priest that set us, though guilty, free again. So it's real interesting typology that God wove into just the political social structure of how Israel would behave itself in the land. Yes, sir?
It reads as though the elders had to believe the story that they told.
Yeah, they had to go make their case.
And make the case. Yeah. Because I'm sure there's some guilty people that headed there.
And tried to make their case.
Tried to make their case.
Sure. Now, obviously, they had to be good judges. And what we're going to see in a moment is that when the Levites then are given their cities, one of the cities they're given is the main city of refuge. So you have Levites there who are serving God, serving as the judges in these cases. And I expect that if somebody did slip in, you know, you err on the side of caution there to protect the innocent, hopefully. So then verse 7 says, so they set apart Kadesh in Galilee, in the hill city of Naphtali, and Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah, and beyond the Jordan east of Jericho, they designated Bezer in the wilderness on the plain from the tribe of Reuben, and Ramoth in Gilead from the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan from the tribe of Manasseh. And these were appointed as cities for all the sons of Israel and for the stranger who sojourns among them, that whoever kills any person unintentionally may flee there and not die by the hands of the avenger of blood until he stands before the congregation. Then the heads of the households of the Levites approached Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the households of the tribes of the sons of Israel, and they spoke to them at Shiloh in the land of Canaan, saying, the Lord commanded through Moses to give us cities to settle in and their pasture lands for our cattle. So the sons of Israel gave the Levites from their inheritance these cities with their pasture lands according to the command of the Lord. Then the lot came out for the family of the Kohathites, and these are the sons of Aaron the priest, who were of the Levites. They received 13 cities by lot from the tribe of Judah and from the tribe of the Simeonites and from the tribe of Benjamin. And the rest of the sons of Kohath received 10 cities by lot from the families of the tribe of Ephraim and from the tribe of Dan and from the half-tribe of Manasseh, and the sons of Gershon received 13 cities by lot from the families of the tribe of Issachar and from the tribe of Asher and from the tribe of Naphtali and from the half-tribe of Manasseh in Bashan. In other words, there were Levites scattered among all 12 tribes, both northern and southern. Now, there were, of course, Levites in the southern kingdom. Once Jerusalem was established, once the temple was established, there had to be Levites there to serve in the temple. But the Levites were scattered all through the northern and the southern, and notice yet again the two references to Manasseh on the east side and on the west side of the Jordan River. The sons of Merari, according to their families, received 12 cities from the tribe of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the tribe of Zebulun, and the sons of Israel gave by lot to the Levites these cities with their pasture lands as the Lord had commanded through Moses. And they gave these cities, which are here mentioned by name, from the tribe of the sons of Judah and from the tribe of the sons of Simeon. And they were for the sons of Aaron, one of the families of the Kohathites, from the sons of Levi, for a lot it was theirs first. Thus they gave them Kiriath Arba, Arba being the father of Anak, that is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah with its surrounding pasture lands. Does that sound familiar? That's one of the cities of refuge. But the field of the city and its villages they gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, as his possession. And who did he give it to? His daughter. Exactly right. So, to the sons of Aaron, the priest, he gave Hebron, the city of refuge for the manslayer, and its pasture lands, and Libna with its pasture lands. And then they go through the sons, Jatir, and Holon, and Ain, and what lands they got. Then they go to the tribe of Benjamin and what lands they got. And the rest of that chapter is all the individual lands and properties by tribe that the Levites received. And just as we've done in previous chapters, each chapter that has lists of names and places, I've just advised that you read it in your spare time. And if you can, read it out loud. And then you'll realize how tough my job is when I read these things out loud. All the cities of the Levites, says verse 41, in the midst of the possession of the sons of Israel were 48 cities with their pasture lands. These cities each had its surrounding pasture lands. Thus it was with all these cities. So the Lord gave Israel all the land which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they possessed it, and they lived in it. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and no one of their enemies stood before them. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hand. Not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed. It all came to pass. Now, that verse is a verse that is glommed onto by many, many folk who want to say that all of the promises that God made to Israel are fulfilled, they are complete. And that because of what is said here in Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 through 45, especially the phrase, not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed, it all came to pass. People say, well, see, that's it. What God did for Israel is he kept his word. He took them into the land of milk and honey. He took them through the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, and he delivered them into that land, conquered all their enemies, gave them peace round about, and therefore God did for Israel everything he had promised to do for them. But they, after that, they then failed to keep his word. They then failed to follow after him. They chased after foreign gods. All the stuff that we know is the history of Israel, and therefore God drove them out of the land, starting with the Babylonian captivity and going on from there. And that the reason that they have been out of their land all the way up until 1948, and of course you can even argue, as I do, that 1948 is only the return of Southern Kingdom participants. All you're seeing there are predominantly Judahites, Jews. You're not seeing Northern Kingdom folks coming back. And so the argument is that the reason that the Jews have not been in their land, especially since like 70 AD and forward, is because they were not faithful to God, they didn't follow his word, and therefore God is done with Israel. Therefore God kept his word, he did everything he was going to do, Joshua says so. Having done everything he promised he was going to do, God faithfully did that, end of that story, but then they were not faithful, so the curse that was a part of the law that God promised them, if you don't do it my way, I will drive you out of the land and I will bring your enemies upon you, God was faithful in doing that, and then that's the end of Israel. God's done dealing with Israel altogether at that point. And of course, you know from our recent Israelology study, I don't agree with that conclusion whatsoever. But really, really importantly, in the book of Hebrews, turn there, in the book of Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews, who I believe is Paul/Barnabas, gives us a response to exactly what we just read here. So we need to let the New Testament interpret the Old Testament. Turn to Hebrews 4. Hebrews 4, starting in verse 1. The book of Hebrews, which is the book that I want to preach verse by verse through next, which will take us a nice long time to do, but I actually think that we're kind of reaching the point now as a congregation, as a group, especially the Wednesday night crowd, so you're the special group. We're kind of reaching that point where we've got enough Old Testament background and sense of Hebrew history that we can make some sense of the book of Hebrews. Unfortunately, far too many 21st century Gentiles with no comprehension of what's going on in the Old Testament just go charging into the book of Hebrews thinking that it's some kind of promise box to 21st century Gentiles and work very hard to try to apply that book to the church of the modern day. And even though the same way that we read through the Pentateuch and found a tremendous amount of education in it. There are big portions of the book of Hebrews that are a tremendous comfort to the people of God and believers in Christ, and a lot of it does apply to us in as much as we understand the faithfulness of God and the finished work of Christ. But there are huge portions of the book of Hebrews that are about the end of the law and the better priesthood and all of that kind of stuff that is wonderful, marvelous, intellectually stimulating, really educational, great stuff to know, but it does not directly apply specifically and only to the 21st century church. It has to do with the Hebrews who are being written to. It's a book written by a Hebrew to Hebrews. That's the target audience. And so there are many, 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 many references in the book of Hebrews to Old Testament ideas and concepts and history. And if you don't know that history, it's really hard to understand the book of Hebrews, which is why it's taken us this long as a church to even reach the point where I think we could probably approach the book of Hebrews now. It's going to be a tough one, but we can do it. So it starts with a warning. I said all that to say, typical of the way the Old Testament writes to Israel, full of warnings. The writer of Hebrews does the same thing. I get email every so often from people who are trying to read through or work their way through the book of Hebrews, and they say, what are all these warnings to believers? I mean, if we're eternally secure in the finished work of Christ, why all these warnings against failing? Well, it's because it's a Hebrew writing to Hebrews, and he's writing to a group of people who have a long history of warnings from God. And now, using that same literary approach, the writer of Hebrews says, now remember all the warnings in the Old Testament, and now apply that same mindset to the reality of what God has done in Christ. And if you don't heed what is done in Christ, how do you think you're going to escape when your forefathers didn't heed what happened at Sinai and didn't escape? So if they couldn't escape the law that came from angels at Sinai through Moses, a mediator, how can you think you're going to escape if you ignore what God did through Jesus Christ? That's a good warning. But it is, in fact, a warning. So, chapter 4, verse 1 starts with a warning. Therefore, let us fear lest, while a promise remains of entering his rest, any one of you should seem to come short of it. Okay, look at this. A Hebrew writing to Hebrews, knowing the whole history of Israel and the history of the Hebrews, now says to them, we're still looking for that rest we've been promised. Because the promises made to Israel was someday they'd be regathered in their land, never to be uprooted again, never to leave again, safe, plenty to eat, plenty to drink, never to worry or leave again. That hasn't happened. And as this writer was writing 2,000 years ago, it still hadn't happened. So he says, let us fear lest while the promise remains of entering into his rest, any one of you should seem to have come short of it. For indeed, we have had good news preached to us, just as they also. But the word they heard did not profit them, because it was not united by faith in those who heard it. So who are the others who heard good news but didn't accept it in faith? He's talking about the progenitor. He's talking about Israel. He's talking about the national history of Israel. For we who have believed enter that rest. Just as he has said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. That goes all the way back to Psalm 95:11. David now talking about Israel, being angry with Israel, and saying, I've sworn in my wrath they won't enter into my rest, although, because the writer is clearly a sovereignist, clearly understands the absolute sovereignty of God, so he says, I swore in my wrath they shall not enter my rest, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. So he throws in, by the way, this is all by design. Now remember your Israelology. Remember what I've been saying. This is all by design. God knows what he's doing. He's working with the church right now. And when the fullness of the Gentiles be come in, then all Israel will be saved. All this stuff is the same story being told by the same God all the way through the Bible. But the works were finished from the foundation of the world. Now look at this. For he has said somewhere this concerning the seventh day, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. That's Genesis 2:2. But then again, there is this passage, they shall not enter into my rest. That's what we just read. And then he says, since therefore it remains for some to enter that rest, and those who formerly had the good news preached to them failed to enter that rest because of disobedience, he again fixes a certain day. Today, saying through David, after so long a time, just as he has said before, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. Now, here's the point that he's making. That's from Psalm 95:71. Here's the big picture. He says, okay, it's true that God put them in their land. And it's true that he gave them rest for their enemies, and everything we just read from Joshua is true. But then they were disobedient, and so God drove them out of their land, and God said, exactly what we read, I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. But the whole plan was designed since before the foundation of the world. And then he says, and so later, David says, today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts. And holds out a promise, today, which is long after all the bad stuff, today, if you hear his voice, harden not your hearts, and offers again rest to the children of Israel. Now, why would he be holding out rest yet again after God had said, I swear in my wrath, they will not enter my rest? He answers that in verse 8. Now, if you're reading from a King James, anybody here reading a King James? The King James says, for if Jesus. That's a bad translation. The word is Yeshua, so it was mistranslated by the King James translators as Jesus. No, he's talking about Joshua. He's talking about the history of Israel. He's talking about what we just read. For if Joshua had given them, and the word rest there is permanent rest. If Joshua had given them the permanent rest they were looking for, follow the logic, if he had, he would not have spoken about another day after that. Well, there you go. There's the New Testament commentary on what we just read out of Joshua. Joshua writes, they had rest round about them. God gave them all the promises he had given them. But the writer of Hebrews says, remember the works of God were designed before the foundation of the world, and everything that has fallen out for Israel fell out according to his divine plan since before the foundation of the world. And if Joshua had given them the permanent final rest that God intended for them, he wouldn't have later held out the offer of rest yet to come. Isn't that brilliant? Now, for the folks who say God is completely done with Israel and they point to the Joshua passage, they haven't bothered to understand the Hebrews passage. And remember, we're supposed to understand the Old Testament in light of what the New Testament writers have written. And if we just follow that rule, then we have to understand that there is still a rest remaining for the people of God, for the Hebrews. Joshua did not give them that long-anticipated final rest. And so God, through David, still holds out the offer of a day of rest. So verse 9 says, there remains, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. A final rest. A permanent rest. And then he says, for the one who enters into his rest has himself also rested from his works, as God did from his. So he reaches back to that God rested on the seventh day thing, and he says, the one who really achieves genuine Sabbath, and this is what the whole Sabbath is pointing to, the one who achieves real rest in God is the one who has no reliance or dependence on his works, on his own ability. He rests in the finished work of Christ. He rests in the better covenant based on better promises with a better high priest. The things that the Old Testament couldn't accomplish, the New Covenant does accomplish. And when you rest in that, that is that final Sabbath fulfillment rest for the people of God. Now, everybody in the New Covenant, all of us who know Christ, all of us who have the Spirit of God in us, that's where we find our rest. That's where we find our comfort. That's why people say to me so frequently, the fellow who came and visited this Sunday. He said, you don't know what you've done for me. And I said, it wasn't me. I didn't do anything for you. He said, I have comfort, rest. I have confidence. I'm not afraid anymore because I've come to understand what the God of the Bible is really like, and I get his promises. And we've all had that experience, the phenomenal rest and comfort and security that comes in knowing the truth and understanding the doctrine that adorns God. And all that good stuff brings about a comfort and a rest. But Israel, the Hebrews, they have not yet entered into that final rest, because they have not yet entered into the new covenant, which is promised to be theirs in Jeremiah 31 and in Hebrews 8. In the book of Hebrews, he's going to quote it verbatim and once again promise it to the house of Israel and the house of Judah, who are consistently the northern and southern tribes. And they are the direct recipients of the promise of the new covenant, because they are the ones that are under the old covenant. But they're not there yet. So the writer of Hebrews says to them, there is still a rest held out for you. Therefore, the rest that Joshua provided could not be the final rest. Now, that's the New Covenant, New Testament theology. Anybody who uses Joshua's words to say that God is finished with Israel is flat wrong. Yeah?
Makes sense.
It makes sense because it's the Bible. Just let the Bible say what it says. All right, so I'll tell you what. That was a lot of stuff for one night. We covered a lot of ground. Next week, we'll pick up at chapter 22 of the book of Joshua, because that's the point at which finally those tribes that have land on the east of Jordan finally return. And when they get over there, they do something that their brethren on the west of the Jordan find so offensive that the tribes on the west declare war on the tribes to the east. So there's your coming attractions. And it's all about proper worship of God. And so we'll look at that next week. We'll get into chapter 22. So we covered some ground tonight, didn't we?
Yes.
Yeah. Are you glad you came?
Yes.
Did you learn anything?
Yes.
Good. Glad to hear it. Any questions?
See how long I'll remember.
No.
That's why it's on tape. Yeah. When you go, hey, wait, there's something here about Joshua. Wait, let me get that tape. There's an MP3 on the website. He'll say it. Just let him say it.
The Jews in Israel now seem to be content with staying on the west side of the Jordan.
Yeah.
Do you think they would really want to have the land on the west side?
Ultimately, according to the Abrahamic covenant, they get the land all the way to the Euphrates River.
Yeah.
And they've never had that. Even here in this division of land, they've never had that. So there's a lot of the Abrahamic covenant yet to bring to fruition that even, yet again, I'll state, even Joshua didn't bring about the full land inheritance that Abraham was promised. So there again, you've still got Abrahamic promises that have never in history come to their fruition. And what are you going to do with those? You got to say, well, God's going to do it.
Yeah. In the final way.
Yeah. But you're right. I mean, the modern day Israel is quite content to stay west of the Jordan. But, you know, you get over into Transjordan on the other side, it's just all enemies now anyway. Every time they try to make peace, they give up another piece of land. Everybody around them wants to shove them into the sea. So they are really fighting just to exist at this point. But that's pretty much the way the Bible describes it. The times of the Gentiles encroaching on Israel's land, it's coming to a head. And at some point, God's going to either have to intervene, or we're going to see a terrible conflagration. But if the Bible's true, and I'm going with it is, that's geopolitically exactly how it's going to be set up when Christ comes back. And I can't avoid that.
It's just so miraculous that this is just so described, so almost like it is in the newspaper.
Yeah. Yeah, and you use the right word, Gladys. It is miraculous. And that's why I teach this book. And that's why I just keep teaching and teaching and teaching this book.
That lays out what we are as people.
Yeah.
And what the world is.
Right.
And what it's coming to. I mean, it's describes the perfect.
It proves itself, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. If you'll just take the time, and I keep telling people this, whether you accept the Bible or reject the Bible, at least know what it is you're accepting or rejecting. Most people who claim to be Christian and who claim to, you know, be Bible believers don't know what the Bible says. They haven't taken the time to study the book, and most people who reject it have never studied it and don't know what it says. And so, you know, my goal in my lifetime, as long as I got any breath left, is to teach the book. Here's what the book says. Here's how it works. Here's how it interconnects. Because, believer or not, if you'll just look at the evidence, you got to come away with, if this is a man-made book, then these guys were geniuses. Because it's a book with one author writing by a whole lot of hands. Because it all interweaves and connects just so amazingly beautifully that I'm convinced it's the Word of God, and I'm willing to stake my eternity on that. So I like your word. It's miraculous.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.